This episode of Behind the Video is brought to you by the Independent Media Network. The Independent Media Network helps journalists and content creators create their own jobs by building sustainable online businesses. If you're an unemployed or underemployed journalist or content creator, visit IMNCT.com for more information. Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of Behind the Video. This is episode 74, and joining me as always is my lovely and talented co-host Tim Street, who assures me that his internet has been fixed, the cable guy came out and everything, right Tim?
Yeah, I just have to stop talking bad about certain ISP people, and then my internet works fine. So as long as I don't mention any names of corporate evil places,
You should be fine. So, well, that is good to see you back and looking better than ever in the always improving Google Hangouts app. And we have a guest today, a very special guest, Tim. And who is that?
Well, we have somebody who comes to us from the television world who does something that you wouldn't expect in television, and that's creating languages for shows like Game of Thrones. David, you want to tell us about yourself? David J. Peterson.
Hello, and thanks for having me. Yeah, so my name is David Peterson.
Yeah, so David, what do you do?
I create languages, and that's pretty much my job at this point. Or at least that's how I make money. So I started out working on HBO's Game of Thrones. I created the Dothraki language, and then later the High Valyrian language, and an offshoot of it, Astapori Valyrian, which is a variant of Low Valyrian. And then I work on Defiance, where I created three languages: Castathan, Raytheon, and Indogene. And then I started work on another show called Starcrossed on the CW that nobody's heard of yet because it hasn't debuted. But I created a language there called Sondive. Sounds very French and snooty, which I love. And I created a language for a pilot for sci-fi that I haven't heard if it's got picked up yet. We'll see. And I created the Dark Elf language for Thor, The Dark World.
How long does it take to create a language? It doesn't seem like it's a simple process, right?
Yeah, well, ideally you should have about a year, but usually with Hollywood you've got about 2 months, if that. So I have a way of fudging it for a little bit until I can then go back and fix things up later. And I usually don't make too many mistakes.
And do the fans call you out on it if you do?
Yes, they do. That's actually one of the things that I think that at least some, you know, directors, producers, they don't get. They always say, well, you know, if they make a mistake, nobody's going to know except you. And that's not true. Nobody's going to know immediately, but they'll figure it out. They always figure it out, and I'm always the one that has to deal with it.
It's got to be challenging to do that. So you start off kind of, I guess, if you only have a two-month time span, it's just an overview kind of language, right, where you have enough to meet the script requirements. What are some of the challenges, though? Do you think about what kind of depth you have to add later? How do you start? Is there a simple process you follow? Is there, you know, because I'm thinking back to, like, you know, Spanish class with verb conjugation and all this other stuff. Are there basic frameworks that you start from? What's the process?
Well, I guess a framework, not in the sense for creating the language, but at least for filling out the document so I remember what things I have to account for. But really, all languages are the same. What they have to do is be able to translate any possible thought or means of expression that we might have. And they just do it in different ways. So at the beginning, you just have to make sure that it meets the translatability goal, but you know, creatively you can do whatever you want with it. I think one of the things that some people are confused about as far as the size of a language is the grammar tends to be pretty fixed. So once it gets to a certain point, it's pretty much done. It's just the words, the lexicon, that, you know, takes the rest of your life to fill out. So that's the part that takes a long time. So when it comes to doing something new, I might only have the number of words that I need to translate whatever's in the script. Usually not. Usually I have more, but I that's all I would need. But the grammar needs to be able to handle any possible sentence. Even if you didn't have even if you didn't have a noun for chair, you have to be able to translate any possible sentence that would use a noun in any type of position, so forth.
Fascinating stuff. And what's the background that you had to get into this? Are you a linguist by trade? Did you study world languages, or is this something that you developed on your own?
No, I've studied linguistics at UC Berkeley. I got a BA there and then a master's in linguistics at UC San Diego. At the same time, when I started studying linguistics, I also started creating languages just for fun. And it's been for about, it was 13 years ago, I think. So I've just been creating languages the entire time. And then I also study languages for fun. I started that back at my last year in high school, when I discovered that it would be really fun to just learn more languages, and I tried to learn as many as I could. And I kept up with that pretty much, and actually picked up more lately.
If I said that I watched a video last night, what would that mean?
That means that you watched a video. What's the trick here?
I guess what I'm bringing up is that in languages, you know, like even in English, the meaning of something could change. If I said I watched a video, you might think I watched a video on YouTube or I watched something on Netflix, when actually I either watched a VHS or I watched a music video on MTV. That meaning has changed. And so where I'm going with this is, do you have that in the structure of the languages that you're creating? Do things change over time?
Yeah. That's actually the simplest part of language change, which is just meaning change, because that's the type of thing that changes over a generation. Back in the 90s, if you said I watched a video last night, it really did mean a VHS tape, because that was the most salient example. Or if you were a teenager, it meant you watched something on MTV back when MTV was relevant. Now the most salient example is just a video on YouTube or anything else, but basically an internet video. That's kind of the most salient example of the word video. And it would be extremely atypical to say that you threw in a VHS, even though I still haven't got rid of mine, and I still have a VHS player. I can't give it up. I don't think. Oh no, we did replace Casablanca, but I don't have another. No wait, I think I did replace Edward Scissorhands, but there's a lot of videos I just don't have. I'm sorry, on DVD or just streaming or whatever. But there's three basic components to language change. One of them is semantic change, and that's what you're talking about here. And that's something that the meanings of words can change over a generation in slight ways or in larger ways. And then the easiest example is really with slang, and usually with adjectives. So how, something like bad can go from meaning bad to meaning good in the 80s to generally meaning bad again. I mean, you can't really say bad anymore. You have to say badass in order to get that old meaning, I think.
So when you're doing this for shows, do you go into that depth, or is it just not, you don't have the time to deal with slang?
Well, I don't have the time, but I do it anyway. You have to, is the thing. Because if you're producing a realistic language, the only way to create a language that looks like the languages that we have in our world is to produce that same level of linguistic depth. And so really what I do is I generally start with a proto-language and a usual kind of handy hallmark is to start 1,000 years before whatever time you need the language. Our languages go back much further than that, but 1,000 years is a good enough time to show a fair amount of change that actually produces something replicable. It's kind of like, I don't even think if you go 1,000 years before, let's say 1900. I don't think that you even have Vulgar Latin. Still, Vulgar Latin would have been moved on. But it's like from very old Spanish to modern Spanish, if you think. And there was enough of a change there that you could actually see a big difference. So I start with that proto-language, and that's usually created a priori, maybe with some hints of further depth beyond that. Then I take that proto-language and evolve it, evolving the grammar, the meanings of words, and also the sounds. And those are the three basic ways that languages change. over a simulated period of 1,000 years to produce the modern version of the language.
And do you start with something familiar? You know, maybe in the case of the Game of Thrones, they're humans, they're not aliens. So do you look at like bases like Latin and that kind of thing, or do you start from scratch as well?
No, you start from scratch. You don't really need to do that anymore. If you've been creating languages for a while, you don't need to do that anymore. Lots of people start off that way, and I started off this way. If you go to my old website, you'll see a bunch of languages where it's like, this one was clearly based on Turkish because I was really into Turkish. This one was clearly based on Hawaiian because I was into Hawaiian and so forth. But after you do that for a while, you just start to really understand how languages can vary and the ways that they can vary. And so you can just really just jump in there and do exactly what you want. And achieve the effect that you're interested in achieving without having to worry about, basing it on another language.
It's really fascinating.
Do you teach any of your languages that you've created? Have you done seminars on them?
No, I do the occasional presentation at like a fantasy or sci-fi convention, but I don't think I'd have the patience to teach a language. Any language, even a spoken language, I just get too annoyed at the mistakes that were being made, and then annoyed at myself when I made mistakes. It would just be a frustrating experience.
Now, when you get angry, do you start yelling in Klingon or a different language? Would you consider yourself to be proficient in the languages that you're creating? Could you speak to another person if they were as well?
No. There are different types of people when it comes to learning and using languages. And some people are very adept at speaking them right off, and they don't worry about the mistakes they make. I'm much more of the other type that will sit there for an hour and make sure that I've composed just the right sentence, and then I'll spit it off fluently, and then the person will have a fluent response, and I'll be, fuck, it's just done. I've never been super good at just the conversant part. So like with the languages I created, I know the grammars very, very, very well, and I can write them pretty well, but speaking them just off the cuff is just well beyond me. And that actually goes for most of the languages I've studied. I get too hung up on myself, whereas I've met people where it's like in Spanish, I know that my level of comprehension and is my fluency is much better than theirs, but they'll just rattle off in Spanish. They'll make dozens of mistakes, but it won't matter because they're still getting the basic points across, and they're still essentially being functionally more fluent than I am as I'm trying to make sure that I get every single subjunctive just right.
It's got to be tough sometimes.
I'm curious. How do you go from creating languages to getting a job in television creating languages for a TV show?
Well, ordinarily you didn't. And in fact, before me, you didn't. I think probably the only qualification you could have had to create a language for a show was not to have created a language before, because that was the case with everybody who'd done it before me. In my case, we just kind of lucked out. It was just happenstance that there was a book that was really popular at the time when the showrunners for Game of Thrones were doing the pilot. They had the pilot greenlit. And so what happened, there was a book that was really popular at the time, or it made the New York Times bestsellers list, called In the Land of Invented Languages by Erica Okrent, which was about created languages and also language creators. And so they contacted her, actually, and then she sent them to the Language Creation Society, which had helped her with some research for her book. And the Language Creation Society put together an application process and announced it to everybody that created languages. So I applied, and then I just happened to get the job.
And the rest is history.
Are you a fantasy and sci-fi person yourself? Do you enjoy that, or are you just strictly a language guy?
To an extent, I like movies and TV shows. I'm not really a reader of fantasy and sci-fi. But then I guess I've always had a tortured relationship with reading my entire life, so it's no surprise. But I grew up watching Star Trek: The Next Generation. I remember that I had heard, I guess, of Star Trek when I was very young, but a neighbor on my street came in and showed me the first episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation when it aired. I was in first grade, so I didn't really follow it, but I knew that it was something interesting. So I, you know, kept watching it along with billions of other TV shows. That's what I did as a kid. I just watched TV shows. My mother said as long as I got my homework done, I could do whatever I wanted. So I watched TV every single day. Didn't matter what. TGIF, Popeye, I Love Lucy, MASH. What was Barney Miller? Whatever. I've seen everything. I've seen every episode of everything. But yeah, so I loved Star Trek growing up. I had no idea that there was a language in it. I knew of Lord of the Rings. I had no idea there was a language in it. I didn't even know people created languages until college. But yeah, I'm a big fan of especially but movies and TV shows. I loved Star Wars growing up. Pretty much, if there was really kind of cool special effects, I was there.
Now, when somebody comes to you and they're like, hey, we'd like you to create a language, how do you go out about pricing your services? Do you have a way to walk them through it? Because, I mean, I'm a producer, and if I come to you and go, hey, I've got this show that takes place on Earth, but it also takes place in outer space, and I need the outer space people to speak another language, but they also speak English, and sometimes it's like Spanglish, they mix them together. Yeah. Where do you start on a conversation in setting up pricing structure for that?
Really, it's just based on my previous work. So, you know, the other shows that I'm doing and also how much time I have because I've gotten busy lately. But, it usually seems to work out all right.
Do you have an agent or do you put together a bid for them? I mean, just kind of general terms, how do you work?
No, I usually just negotiate one-on-one with them. I'm sure I could probably benefit from having an agent, but I don't know if they'd know what to do with me. It's not like there's always going to be steady and regular work for somebody who's creating languages, and it's not something that I think agents will have a lot of experience with. But, you know, maybe one day.
There are people that are doing this, like with the new Superman movie, somebody created the Krypton language, right?
Kind of. They contacted somebody nearby. That's what they'd done for every single project before. They just went to a nearby university and said, "Does somebody want to help out with this?"
Gotcha.
One would hope that it would happen differently now, but yeah.
So, David, I looked on your resume too. You're also an alien culture consultant. So I would imagine languages and culture go hand in hand. What's involved with that, and how do you think about alien cultures? Given we haven't experienced any yet, do you try to think outside the box when coming up with how a culture might interact with humanity?
Well, with Defiance, which is where I started with this, it's kind of a question. Defiance was a pretty unique unique opportunity because what happened is the guy who was the driving force for Defiance, Rockne O'Bannon, who wrote the first pilot, left the show kind of abruptly before it really got started, and so then a new showrunner was brought on, Kevin Murphy. And, you know, it was this thing where this is a property that I guess, you know, the head guy, it wasn't his idea, it wasn't his baby. And so what he decided to do was kind of open things up and say, you know, we have this massive world, this massive idea. Anybody who has ideas, you know, we're all going to be kind of owners of this property. Let's all contribute and make it something good. And so in that case, you know, I was the alien language and culture consultant, but I wasn't the only one creating stuff. So it was kind of like everybody had some ideas, basic ideas for what the different aliens were going to be like, you know, the Castathans and the Arathians. And then we all just kind of started contributing different bits. Would it be cool if they did this? Would it be cool if they did this? So in that case, there's a couple things. First, I want to make sure, like, kind of almost my job on that show is to make sure things aren't too human, too stereotypical, or too much like another show. And so, when it comes to these guys, I really look at them more as almost like humans that have no connection to Earth. Because if you look at them, did I disappear? I think I disappeared. Or did Tim disappear? Okay, Lon disappeared. Sorry, all right. Tim, are you still there?
Yeah. You're still on.
Okay. If you look at the aliens that are in Defiance, for example, they're basically humanoid, and some of the things that make us really uniquely human are the same about them, which is that we still have to, the aliens, just like us, they still have to work together to accomplish things and survive. You can't just have one go off on its own and survive and thrive. They still kind of produce offspring in the same way. Offspring are still weak and need to be nurtured. Very mammalian in a way.
So, Tim, do you want to move on to the news?
Yeah, let's move on to the news. What is going on this week?
Well, there is a lot going on this week, and we will start with our YouTube top five of the week. And David, feel free to chime in on anything that is of interest, but no pressure. We won't quiz you on any of the YouTube news. But what I wanted to do this week, Tim, you know, we've been always trying to find different ways to look at the charts. So I went to the TubeMogul most viewed charts of the week, and most viewed channels, that is. And number five was the X-Men movies. And what I did this time is I pulled out all the Vivo stuff because, you know, the music videos get played a lot, and I figured we should look at creators. So X-Men movies, one video, 19.4 million views for the week. It's actually higher now than it was earlier in the week, and that's, of course, due to the trailer that they just released for one of the new X-Men movies there. So that was a big one. Sky does Minecraft, number four. Our game player guy continues to do well there. David, do you do video game work too?
Well, I've worked a little bit on the Defiance video game. Because it's the concomitant show and video game. But other than that, I guess I just play them.
Because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of story now working their way into these things, and I would imagine a lot of languages too, right?
You'd think the possibility is there, but it's been harder to break into the game industry. They're usually happier with just having somebody that already works for them just make up something on the spot.
Right.
Let's have the interns work on it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Hey, kid, create a language for us. And you're off and running with it, because I know that. You know, there's a Star Wars game that's been out for a long time. It's about 10 years old. It's a role-playing game, Knights of the Old Republic. And the characters all, you know, have verbal talking, and there's a lot of different races and species, and probably beyond what, you know, they developed for the movies. And there's a lot of blah, 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 blah. I hear a lot of repetition. So I imagine they're just saying the same gibberish every time, and you're reading the thing below it. But
yeah, all gibberish.
And yeah. Gibberish sounds the same, right?
Yeah, Skyrim was just intern work.
Right. So it's got to drive you nuts to hear that when you're playing the game.
There are so many language creators too that would just, you know, kill for the opportunity to do something like that. They'd probably even do it for free, though I shouldn't say that.
But, yeah. Just to keep the crap from getting into the game, right? So
yeah, you know.
Well, number three on our list, who does speak some sort of language, is Smosh at 19.8 million views this week. And number two is actually a non-English channel. That is LA Corn HD3. It's actually Thai television. Tim, 22 million views. Full Screen is their channel, is their multi-channel partner.
Good, gotta love that. Good move by Full Screen, right?
Yeah, expanding.
And what were they showing?
You may have to watch it so you could tell us what they're saying. They have a number of web series on there. They're all in Thai. I think, yeah, and you know, it's one of these things. We saw this last week with, last week it was a Turkish music channel that was number one on the list.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it's just such an international thing. I look on my own channel where, I went and looked at where my revenue was coming from, because you can see where, you know, where your views and revenue come from. And, mm-hmm. you know, the United States is a majority of where my dollars are coming from, mainly because I'm reviewing U.S. products for my YouTube channel. But I'm getting a lot of overseas too. It's pretty remarkable. It's a real international marketplace.
Maybe you should start reviewing Disney toys.
I think that niche has been covered by the Disney collector. So David, you'll get a kick out of this. There's a woman who reviews all the toys that are Disney branded. A whole bunch of stuff. And what she does, she's called the Disney collector. She opens up the boxes, takes everything out, and talks about it. Okay. She had 36.6 million views in just the last week alone.
Okay, and does she have all of the gummy bears?
She probably does, and if not, she can afford to buy them. Because, Tim, what do you think she's making on this, right? I mean, we're talking
My guess is that if she's, you know, fully monetizing this, she's probably doing between 250,000 and half a million a month.
That is remarkable. And she's no affiliation, she's just herself.
Wow. I would love to see that, especially if she's overly critical. Wow, here's another piece of crap.
You know what's funny is she passes no judgment on any of this stuff. I have watched a couple of them. My excuse is that I have a 6-month-old, so I'm doing research. She just takes everything out of the box and just shows how it works. And I think I think her audience are kids, you know, little kids that are, you know, looking about, you know, how to spend their allowance, but also the parents, right? And you know, it's intriguing. And Tim, I'm going to try to get this guy on because I was talking to this guy who a friend of mine works with him. He blows stuff up.
Oh, and that's good. That's good. That's good for kids. Kids should do more of that.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Debt cord. You know, he shoots things with high caliber machine guns. Like, he does all this crazy stuff.
He's probably very close friends with ATF.
He is. He's got a license, apparently, or so I'm told. But what's fascinating, though, in talking with my friend who has been talking with him, is that I'm getting a higher CPM than he is. And I think it's because of the audience, right? Like, there's an audience thing here that there are a lot of kids and a lot. And if you think about it, Google is selling advertising on the audience. Content is not the scarcity point. It's the audience is the scarcity point. And my gut is that channels that appeal to young teenage boys are not going to monetize as well as channels that appeal to adults.
Right. Makes sense.
So I think there's a lot more scarcity in the marketplace. We're going to try to get him on, and we'll talk a little bit more about him. And I'm going to try to talk to him offline about it, too, because I think it'd be interesting to see that.
Maybe you should leave a comment on his YouTube channel.
Yes, we should, because if it'll let you do it. So this week was the big – well, actually, last week was the big rollout week, but it had just started when we did last week's show. 88,000 users have spoken out against the new YouTube comments because they now incorporate Google Plus. I'm going to gripe about the fact that Google Plus can't keep this show up for for a little bit longer, but we're also not paying them for this, so I shouldn't complain too much.
You get what you pay for, Lon.
You do.
Yeah, actually, I checked the latest number. It's up to 112,000. That's as of Reddit today.
Wow. So people are not happy. You know, YouTube is kind of like the like a small town. When you change anything, people are not happy, you know. But I think there's some validity to this, mainly because, you know, unlike a lot of channels, and I'm always jinxing myself by saying this, but I get a lot of useful comments in my channel, and you know, people asking questions, people helping each other out. It's really been kind of a nice thing to see, you know, some humanity going on YouTube comments. And what's happened is that depending on how your Google Plus settings are set up, you could leave a comment on my channel and I can't reply to it on my own channel. So the comment is publicly visible on the YouTube channel and presumably on Google Plus, but because whatever their settings are don't allow me to comment directly, it doesn't work. But
if you were a spam company, you could totally leave a comment there about Viagra.
Of course, because that would totally work. And unfortunately, our friend Clintus McGinnis got caught up in a debate on this issue, and people were posting ASCII drawings of things that aren't safe for this show, but it's going to be an issue to try to get these things integrated. I thought it was kind of a good thing in the sense that you could at least have identities tied to this. Another problem that Google Comments have had for a long time is you couldn't link to other sites, and apparently this Google Plus version lets you do that. You can call out other folks in the comment stream, so it does bring all the Google Plus functionality over to YouTube comments, but it hasn't really been a flawless implementation, which is not surprising because things never, if you even look at the healthcare thing, nothing ever gets implemented smoothly. So hopefully they'll work out this stuff. But I'm not as upset about it as other people are. Tim, what are you hearing about this? Are people like ready to go to pitchforks to YouTube HQ here?
Yeah, some people are. I mean, they're really begging YouTube to fix this and fix it quick. Some people have turned off their comments. They've just disabled comments. because the spammers have been able to get in and really ruin channels. So who knows? You know, I mean, maybe it's going to be an opportunity for somebody to launch a new channel off of somebody else's back by spamming their comments,
right.
And then maybe they'll get a TV show deal out of it.
That could, because there has been yet another crossover in from YouTube to the big time. NBC has nabbed YouTube star Shane Dawson, who is going to do a half-hour comedy show on NBC. And I guess it's about time. I think we'll see more of this happening, mainly because some of these YouTubers have more traffic than the networks do, right?
Like I think it's great that Shane Dawson is getting a deal, but a deal from NBC, it just feels like not a brand fit at all. I mean, if you watch Shane Dawson, he's very irreverent. He's sexual. He, can be very liberal in his interpretations of things. There's lots of cross-dressing. To me, if he was on a, like Comedy Central or something like that, I could see it flying. But with NBC, it just seems too general of a network for somebody as creatively talented as Shane Dawson. So I imagine there's going to be some fights in the development rooms about what he can and can't do.
Yeah, the network censors, I can just see this. Maybe they'll make a bit out of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But who knows? Maybe they'll make a book out of it.
They could, because that's the other thing here, another top YouTube thing, because that's Tim did this to me, and I didn't know what the heck he was talking about. What does the Fox say? I had to go look that up. This was a few weeks ago. I'm now more with the times. But
well, what does the Fox say?
I can't remember. What does the Fox say? Ah, there you go. So
you gotta do it, man.
You gotta do it. So the Fox says that, and it's going to print. So I guess now, see, one of the things as a new parent that you begin to loathe is when people, you love the fact that people want to get things for the baby, but when they get you things that make noise like that, that could be a real problem. So Tim, is this going to be one of those books that makes noise, or is it just going to be an illustrated?
Well, here's the thing, is like it's supposed to be an illustrated children's book, which is great and everything, but the song just seems so targeted at young adults and teenagers and people that are into cosplay. Now there is a little kid that sits on Grandpa's lap in the middle of the video reading him a book. So okay, but I don't see it as a natural fit. So, devil's in the details. It could be something that kids enjoy on one level and young adults enjoy it on a whole nother level.
Kind of like that Go to the F to Sleep book, right?
Yeah, there you go.
I got to say, I am Googling what does the Fox say for the first time, and the Google image search is a wonder of just sheer amazement. There is everything here. I defy anybody who doesn't know what this is to look at a Google image search and then to try to figure out what this is. You will not be able to. I think my favorite so far is there's Marty McFly with his mother from the past, and she says, "What did the fox say?" And it's him replying, "Whoa, heavy."
Ooh, there you go.
Well, I'll tell you what, David, here's an opportunity for you, because the fox language is not developed at all. I think
this
is going to be a book. It's going to be a book, and then it's going to be the cartoon show on Saturday morning, and then you got the royalties from the toy sales, and the Disney collector hasn't even gotten into this yet. So
yes, please, here's my card. Come and contact me.
Call him now and get this done. So, hey, let's talk about some movies real quick. We'll look at the top five from the box office. Again, I'm amazed by like the huge canyon between number one and number five. We'll start with number five, Bad Grandpa.
Don't take the kids to see it, but if you like raunchy movies, go see it.
And this is like one of these reality movies, right? I mean, the budget for these things must be a lot less because it involves kind of candid camera kind of moments, right?
Yeah, they did a really good job. For the most part, it's Grandpa and a kid that plays his grandkid, and they go prank people. And, one of my big problems with Borat was that there would be scenes where you just have two actors together and they're doing funny things, but it kind of spoiled the ground rule of Borat when it was on HBO, and that was that you were always playing, he was always playing a joke on somebody. Whereas this movie, pretty much, I mean, there are times where they're in the car alone, but for the most part, it's good pranks that move the story forward, and it really makes it fun. But don't take your kids. It's pretty bad. An example of how bad it is: Grandpa decides to make love to a Coke machine outside a gas station, and he gets his privates caught in the machine. God. So see his privates caught in the machine. Yeah, it's hilarious, but you don't want to take the kids to see.
Yeah, that's one we're not going to go bring the kids out to. So now you might bring the kids though to Free Birds, which is a Thanksgiving animation film. That one came in at number 4, $7.5 million. You can drop the kids off in there and then go see Grandpa in the other theater. $41.4 million overall. So that one's doing okay. Las Vegas, $7.9 million this weekend, $46 million overall, still hanging on. Best Man Holiday, which is a sequel to The Best Man. It was a movie that came out about 15 years ago. That came in, almost beat out Thor, which surprised a lot of folks. Kid you not. In fact, it was only a $17 million budget to make it. They've already doubled their money, and it's only the first week. And I was reading somewhere where they were talking about how these rankings just don't matter anymore because like internet video, everything is getting into niches. And Best Man Holiday is a film that has a pretty much all African American cast as the first one did, and it's going to have some reach, and it's done really well this weekend. Thor, of course, though, is number one at $34.9 million, and I believe. It's got a pretty all-star cast, another Marvel movie, right? Comic-themed thing. Yeah. So,
It's got a pretty cool language, too, I hear.
Oh, really? So what is it? What's the language of Thor?
I created that, right?
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, well, fantastic. That's awesome. Yeah. So now let's talk about that, because Thor is based on some pretty standard themes in mythology. How did you approach the language for this?
Well, so, Thor and his ilk, they're all, and Asgard, that's all Scandinavian, right? Mm-hmm. The Scandinavian mythos. Their idea was for the Dark Elves, and this came from the director of the Dark Elves. He wanted them to kind of be Finnic, be inspired by Finnish in Finland, the Finno-Ugric languages. So the language that I created for them, which ended up was called Shivaisith. It's got the Finnish vowel harmony system, and then kind of a grammar that I devised of my on my own, so that I could translate things pretty easily. Even though it turned out to be quite difficult, I always make things more difficult for myself than I ought. But it did what it was supposed to do. And I actually finally saw Thor on Friday. I was in Spain when it debuted, so I didn't see it. But I saw it on Friday with friends, and it did everything I wanted to do, which was mainly have Thor and Loki, banter.
In the language.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And how did they do? Did you work with the actors to try to get them up on the language and how to pronounce different words?
For Thor, I didn't. And how they did was they did all right. They did pretty good. It sounded pretty good. But that's all right.
What are like the feel-good moments for you when you're watching your work?
Did I miss the last part of that? Say it again.
What are the feel-good moments for you when you're watching your work be performed?
Oh, yeah. I'm always delighted when the actors actually, produce the entire sentence and say every single word in it. That's a victory. But but then once they've hit that minimum, and most of the time they do, it's just how well it's performed and how well they can make you feel it, because I guess it's hard to quantify in words, but you can tell it on the screen when they really feel what they're doing and they're really feeling the language, and that varies quite a bit, and some of the more outstanding moments really have blown me away. One of them was obviously that scene where Daenerys reveals that she speaks High Valyrian in season 3. That was just incredible. I thought that might have been a high water mark of the series, and it just bowled me over. But then there will always just be, you know, little bits, you know, maybe if it's just like, especially when there's kind of a longer phrase, and I usually get worried about that something's going to get dropped, and they just do it exactly right. It's just, it's wonderful. But yeah, like Tony Curran is one of my favorites. He was in Thor. He played Thor's grandfather in the scenes in the beginning of the movie. And he plays a guy named Daytok on Defiance, and he's always outstanding. I love watching him. He's such a jerk on the show. He's the nicest guy you'll ever meet, but man, his character is just, oh.
Acting.
That's great.
Yeah, acting. Love it.
Hey, Lana, I've got a Nickelodeon joke for you. We used to tell this when I was at Nickelodeon. If you're Russian when you head into the bathroom and you're Finnish when you come out of the bathroom, what are you while you're in the bathroom?
I have no idea.
European. There you go. Good Nickelodeon joke.
It's good clean humor.
Wonderful.
Good clean bathroom humor around the thing there.
There you go.
You know, one thing, there was a sci-fi show, Stargate, which I'm sure you've probably seen, David.
Yep.
And they take this whole Thor and Asgard thing to a whole different direction as well with aliens with their own languages. And it's a shame that the show's still not going. They had a great sequel that just kind of fell out of viewership ratings there. But kind of a neat approach that they took to that story. So you might be able to buy some stuff from Comcast soon, Tim. TV shows and movies through their cable box. I guess you can rent them now, and have been able to for. She's here for like the last 10 years. I can do the on demand.
Seems like the only people blocking this deal are the theater owners, and they are not happy about this going quick. I mean, the cable industry is worried. The theater owners are worried. Everybody's worried
about them selling movies through the cable box.
Yeah, I mean, they don't want stuff to go there right away, and the big push by the studios is to do day and date so that they can get stuff out the door everywhere at the same time and take advantage of all the marketing behind it. And there's a big war going on right now between the studios, the theaters, and the cable companies as to what those windows are going to be, because theater wants to stay on top. They want to be that first window. And if the money's not there and DVD sales aren't picking it up, where are you going to go if you're a studio? What are you going to do? So, you know, money will win out.
Man, let me just say from a consumer's perspective, especially as I get older and crabbier, I would love for there just to be a release date on your television so that when the movie debuts, I just go home and turn on the movie. And if I want to pause it and go to the bathroom, I can do that, and then turn it back on when I get back. I would love that to be our future,
Me too.
If that's going to destroy the entire entertainment industry, which would make
For those of you who are listening to the audio version of the show, just to let you know, David looks like he's in his 20s. My guess would be you're in your 30s, but he definitely looks like he's in his early 20s. So to hear him say that is pretty funny.
Well, I think we're at a stage in life now where health-wise, you know, 60 is the new 30, but mentally, 30 is the new 60. So I think there's days where I get pretty crabby too, and then I go on Tumblr or something and complain about it. But speaking of which, so we have a Canadian producer for our show, Jason Perrier, who is still fighting with the powers that be up there to get an internet connection that he can actually come on the show with. He's supposed to be our news guy, but he can't seem to get his internet to last for more than 10 or 15 minutes at a time.
Uh-huh.
But he's in Canada, so he had to put this thing in here, Tim, from the Hollywood Reporter. Apparently, the mayor of Toronto is getting his own television show while he continues to make. I guess, you know, if you're going to be a train wreck, you may as well cash in on it, right?
Yeah, well, he definitely got some coverage on Saturday Night Live last night, so if you get a chance, check that out. And oh my gosh, Jon Stewart is having a field day with this guy. He keeps begging him to resign. Jon Stewart's like, look, it's bad for me, Mr. Mayor, but you need to resign. He goes, I love you. You know, you're great for my show. You give me so much stuff to talk about. But it's just hilarious. This guy is like, you know, talking about his crack problem, and he's like, yeah, I was really bombed, you know, and it's like he uses his drinking problem as an excuse for his crack addiction.
God, It's just remarkable.
Let me say this. So Defiance Films in Toronto. So I've been up there a few times. And let me tell you, they are so snooty about their city. So I am just loving this scandal. I'm delighted.
I'm sure you need to remind them of this mayor, I'm sure, right?
Oh yeah. No. May he stay in office forever. And even when he's an afterthought, I will remember him always when I'm back up in Toronto. I can promise.
The Rob Ford Foundation. It'll be like a party university or something.
Well, let's see if this TV show will get him out of his job. But something tells me he's going to milk this thing for all it's worth. I guess, you know, if you're going in a certain direction, that, you know, go all the way. What was it, Blagojevich up there in Chicago, Illinois?
Blagojevich. Yeah.
He milked it for all it was worth. He went. What he did the commercials for the pistachio nuts there. He was on. Donald Trump's show there too. He was. He was getting every inch he could get out of that thing before his world crumbled. So we'll have to see what happens. And
he should start a Tumblr called Blagojevich.
Where is he now? Nobody talks about him now because they're all talking about the.
He's in jail, right?
Yeah, he's in jail, and the mayor of Toronto has far surpassed his sleaziness. So we'll see where he goes. So move on to our tip of the week real quick, Tim. So I as you know, down in my basement studio, which we cannot use at the moment because the stupid driver for the software that I use doesn't work with Mavericks, which is a hint for all you kids watching. Don't upgrade until you know everything's going to work.
I haven't.
If you've got stuff that like depends on things, I would be careful with it. But
speaking of that, mm-hmm. I upgraded to Mavericks, but I have not upgraded some of the apps. Like they want me to upgrade Keynote, mm-hmm. they want me to upgrade, and I'm hearing that a lot of people are dissatisfied with the upgraded Keynote. So I haven't upgraded the apps, but I have upgraded the OS.
I did. I also, because I'm stupid, I upgraded the apps too. It'll keep your old ones, so it doesn't overwrite the old ones. And what's nice about the new one, there are some things missing from it, but it will now, like if you have like your Keynote presentation in iCloud, it works on everything.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it really they've done a nice job there. I mean, some of the more detailed things that they missed, you know, but overall I found it works pretty good. And down in my studio, Tim, as you know, I have the Blackmagic switcher. I think I'm going to be talking about a little bit of this at New Media Expo, so I'm looking forward to sharing what I've learned through a lot of expensive mistakes. But I have one of the problems with the Blackmagic switcher is you have to use a computer to do the switching. So you don't have unless you want to spend like another $4,000, you don't have a button you can push. And I've been playing around with a whole bunch of different stuff, and I decided to try a Windows tablet, and I got this Lenovo thing refurb for for nothing because I had affiliate credit.
Let's see. We can't see. Hold it by the mic.
Here it is. There we go. So. It is a full-blown Windows 8 computer that you can hold.
And it's on a tablet.
It's on a tablet.
It's basically like Surface, but it's not a Microsoft brand.
Right. It's a Lenovo, the Lenovo brand. And you know what they've been doing is they've been taking those cheap netbooks and cramming them into tablets. But it works great because I can actually push the buttons and have it do stuff on the switcher, mm-hmm. like you would if you had a real control Surface. So. I found it to be really helpful, and if you have other Windows software you need to run, it'll work. It'll work just like anything else would. They have smaller versions, Lenovo and other manufacturers too. So I think Dell has got one. There's stuff coming out from a whole bunch of different. You know, all the PC manufacturers are coming out with different shapes and sizes. But you can get now like an iPad or smaller size tablet. Asus has a really nice little one that is a full Windows machine in that very small footprint, which is. Wow. I think pretty cool. It's nice to have some.
If I was a Windows guy, I'd be all over it.
But yeah, it could be.
It's like, you know, it's like you talking to me about Pampers right now. I'm not in the market
not
for
doing it. So, and I'm a Mac guy too. Don't get me wrong. I love my Mac, but there's certain things that I was trying to do, and sometimes you got to pick the right tool for the job. And this thing is it's been pretty good. So I'm looking forward to. Playing around with it a little bit more. Although I did find, of course, that because it's Windows, it's a lot more susceptible to stuff. So I was downloading VLC this morning, and I hadn't had my cup of coffee yet. I almost clicked on the link that links you to the unofficial version that installs, you know, Lord knows what on your computer as well.
Nice.
Yeah. So you gotta, gotta keep your guard up on this stuff. It's not like using a tablet that can't get virus. These things all can do that. So, well, David, I want to thank you for joining us today, and sorry for all the technical problems we had, but I think. enough of the show recorded, all of it did, don't worry, we're fine, to be able to get something useful out of there. We really found what you did interesting. Where can people find more about you?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at my horrible Twitter handle that you can't pronounce. It's Daedalus, but it's spelled like it was written in old Latin, so Daedalvs. And then you can plug that into Tumblr and you'll find me. So I think I'm mainly hanging around on Twitter and Tumblr. And then you can also follow my language pursuits on the Dothraki blog, which is dothraki.com.
And you also, you're part of an association that makes up language makers, right?
Yes, I'm also now the president of the Language Creation Society, which is a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to, you know, promoting the art and science of language creation. And you can find us at conlang.org. Conlang is C-O-N-L-A-N-G. Thank you for reminding me.
Oh, no problem. And when you have a meeting, do you have to vote on what language to talk in when you meet?
Oh goodness, it's English or I'm out of there.
The president of my college when I was going to college back in the early days of the 90s, he was an Esperanto enthusiast.
Ah.
So it's still there's still a group out there trying to push that, right?
Yeah, we had to talk in Fortran and Pasquale. So it was, yeah.
Yeah, Tim had binary languages to deal with there. And Tim, where if people were to dial you up on any binary transmission medium, where would they find all of your stuff?
At one Tim Street on Twitter or .com.
And you can find me at Lon Seidman, LonSeidman. The good news is, Tim, I think I figured out why my thing kept dropping out, so I'm going to not repeat the same mistake I did last week or this week.
Overheard.
So we got that fixed, and that is because we have a behind-the-video presence on Google+, and I logged into it the wrong way. So every time I clicked out of the window, it was causing trouble. But we are at behindthevideo.com. That links you to our Google+ community so you can interact with us. We also have a page, plus.google.com, behindthevideo+, will get you to us, plus sign, not P-L-U-S. And we are on Stitcher and iTunes and YouTube, so hit the subscribe button on any one or all of those services. And we record this show every Sunday morning at 11:30 a.m. Eastern, 8:30 a.m. Pacific time. And Tim is always bright-eyed and bushy-tailed with his cup of joe for those early morning Sundays. And we thank you for watching, and we will be back again next week. This show is a wrap.
Stories for this episode were compiled by producer Jason Perrier. Follow him on Twitter at JASONPERRIER. Behind the Video is a production of Ape Digital Incorporated and the Independent Media Network, LLC. All rights reserved.